ist dort disorientiert.
Garvey Words from Messiah and Dread, starting Distant Island episode 109.
It's 5th of October 2012.
How's it going? So on the show tonight we have we're going for quality over quantity.
Yeah, definitely. I've actually heard from a specific listener who I'll give a shout out to later that our interviews get better at the 20-minute mark, and that's when we always cut them off. So this time we're actually going to hit that 20 mark and then keep going for just a little bit longer, and then we're going to cut you off. But yeah, speaking of cuts, the Cuts Cafe, two people in to talk about the Cuts Cafe tonight. We're also going to hear some music, as per usual. And Anya, who can't be here tonight, sadly, has provided a 10-minute piece of audio on porn and capitalism. Anarcho-porn, capitalist porn. We'll hear about it, and it's very intriguing. And then our DJ tonight is the Secret Archives of the Vatican, and we'll also talk to them about their project and open source Creative Commons music and good stuff like that. And then we'll hear some like dubsteppy music from them. So yeah, should be good.
Cool. So in with us now we have Peter and Holly from the Cuts Cafe. How's it going?
Good, thank you.
Yeah. So well, I hear you just had a little run of bad luck.
Well, maybe we should first ask them about the Cuts Cafe phenomenon. Cool. And then we'll talk about the drama. How about that?
Okay.
Because then it will build up. You can wait for the drama. Wait for it. It's coming. But
really
yeah.
So for that 20-minute mark.
Yeah. this isn't a sprint. This is a little bit longer than a sprint. But yeah. So tell us about the idea behind the Cuts Cafe. What is it? What are you trying to achieve here?
Want to have this one?
Yeah. I can start. It's kind of just trying to reignite the anti-cuts movement. It came out of a previous project that we did together called Palestine Place, and realised that having a kind of social centre like that was a really positive thing. So it's building up to the big TUC demonstration. We're not aligned to the TUC, but it's kind of trying to bring a radical edge to the anti-cuts movement, which we feel is maybe slightly dormant at the moment. Although there are lots of people active in many different places, they're not necessarily coming into the one space and talking about the different ways that they're resisting or the things that they're kind of struggling against as a result of the cuts.
And I guess it's kind of framing all of the struggles that are going on against the cuts that are very kind of atomized and in some ways separate. Like you've got, you've got people fighting the closure of like schools and nurseries over here, and you've got students fighting against like cuts to higher education over here, and you've got workers fighting job losses over here, and the unemployed struggling with all of the benefit changes. And it's kind of trying to bring those people together into one place and kind of create a discourse that is saying these problems aren't separate.
Yeah.
These are one big problem, and that problem is capitalism.
Yeah.
And like, the cuts are an expression of that, and the way to fight it is to all come together from our separate struggles, and like not that the coming together is any more important than those individual struggles, but that by coming together we're stronger, and that each of those struggles have lessons to teach each other and things that people can learn from each other. Mm-hmm. And I guess kind of a philosophy that together people can be stronger and create a united front against what is going on, essentially.
Yeah.
So it's a space for that.
Yeah, that's an incredibly ambitious project.
You don't say.
But I mean, I suppose there's a lot to be said for trying to get people from different perspectives or working on different political campaigns into the same space. Cross-pollination of ideas, networking, like space is a really, really important thing. I'm sure you've learned a lot from Palestine Place, actually, which was an incredibly successful project. I heard a lot of really good things about that. So I suppose, are you making an explicit effort to kind of try and reach out as far and widely as possible? And how are you actually doing that? And how is it going so far?
Yeah, definitely. That's been a very much driving force of the outreach and events that we've been doing. I think one of the kind of benefits of what happened with Palestine Place is that it was kind of squatters and anarchists who were the ones who set it up, and then suddenly you got this huge, massive variety of people who came to get involved, and that has really added, I think, to the way that we've done the anti-cuts thing, because people are tapped into these networks that are so broad. I mean, we've got, we're working with Disabled People Against the Cuts, who spoke at our meeting, the Greater London Pensioners Association, teenagers, young people, the unemployed, like really, really trying to engage with with people who are very active, but not in the traditional sense that you would necessarily see in activists. I think there's quite a lot of that happening. There is a very strong activist presence in the events program of Cuts Cafe, but there's also a much broader one than that, and sort of trying to rethink the way that we see and say what an activist is, and trying to recognize that people working in communities and those kind of more community-based projects are not just planning direct action is really important, but there's more that happens outside of those big events that people are doing things all the time to resist, and that's very much part of it.
And I think we've kind of been really lucky with the organising group that we've got, in that it's, like Holly says, it's such a broad range of people, from, like, you've kind of got people like me, the kind of scummy squatter crew, who have a very certain network and hang out in very certain places and can kind of connect to that sort of, like, dressed in black and slightly aggy vibe. And then you've got other people who are kind of working for charities or working for big unions, or various whole different groups. And so there's, like, many more networks than you might sometimes expect from squatted spaces. And then also in terms of the kind of outreach that we've been doing, we've tried to do it in ways and mediums that don't just connect to the same old sort of radical political spheres. So kind of going out into communities and leafleting and approaching sort of community groups and charity groups and saying, hey, like, you know, you guys are doing this, why don't you bring it here and show people what you're doing, and maybe there'll be support for it.
And I think that I think what Palestine Place as well did is was made squatting like a kind of a normal thing, as opposed to like a kind of fringe thing that people were scared of. And I think that that's part of the thing that's going to be hopefully good about the cut space, is that actually the idea behind the space is not a scary one. I mean, like, when I came to Palestine Place, I'd never been involved with activism, I'd never squatted, I'd never met an anarchist, like, so, and I kind of came in and was, like, overwhelmed by the openness of it and the fact that people were willing to have conversations, and that what didn't have to be this, like, angry space all the time. There was a lot of anger, obviously, and I'd imagine there definitely will be in Cuts Cafe, because this is something which is affecting people now and very, very directly. But yeah, I think it will be really great if that same thing can happen, that actually people realise that this idea of radicalism is for everybody. That's the point of it, right? Like, it's not a fringe, like, it's just common sense. So yeah, I think that's what's going to be really exciting, and we've really tried to invite groups in, and yeah.
Are there any groups that aren't invited? Are there any people that you're explicitly saying, like, no, actually, you're not involved, you shouldn't be involved in this project or this space?
I mean, any individual is always welcome to come to the space to share their experiences. You know, obviously with the exception that they're not a sexist, racist, homophobe, whatever, because we want to make it a safe space for us, for everyone. And anyone who belongs to a political party or to a union or any group like that, of course they're welcome. But what we have said is that the space isn't a space for recruitment. It's not a space for political parties, whether they be mainstream political parties or so-called radical political parties, to come and put their party line to people. This is about, like, people's individual experience of the cuts and or groups as well, but not having this kind of, like,
there's no party papers. Well, there will be no selling of newspapers.
that's always one problem, in that, like, when you have a sort of neocon, explicitly neocon government in place, there tends to be a bit more cohesion on the left, and people tend to sympathize with each other a bit more and then try and approach projects together. But the minute that some, like inkling of something that might be sort of tending towards the left's government, not that I'm saying Labour is like that at all, but I'm just saying, like, if that happens, like, in the next election, there was a Labour government, then that might dissipate. And so, like, is that kind of something that's inherent in the project as well, like, this understanding that it has to go beyond party politics and the next election? This isn't just about the cuts now, but it's about, like, the future as well, like, just trying to reconceptualize the way that we're governed.
That's exactly
and in a sense this space is kind of a picture of what we want to see in the future,
like, definitely.
And for us, I think one of the one of the very, very central shared politics of the group is that it's non-hierarchical and autonomous, and that, like, hopefully the space will become kind of some sort of a vision for people to be like, this is the future that we want to see, like, outside of politics.
Yeah, because we know that it works to organise non-hierarchically. We know why, we can see why party politics doesn't work. So why would we kind of want that to be part of a space? We can already see that it's not working, and non-hierarchical organising, especially on this, like, quite localised scale, has been... was massively successful for the last project that we did, has been very successful so far in the planning stages. Yeah, so it's kind of saying, well, like, you know, the politics is broken, and we're going to try and prove why we know that it can be done differently, and why not only can it be done differently, but it will work better when it's done differently. So yeah, I mean, trying to sort of organise in the way that we'd like to see in the future, but also being open to suggestions and not having, like, a sort of, you know, clear party line on it. I mean, you know, to make it an open space to share ideas and for people to come with a range of different politics, and to enter into those conversations, I think.
Excellent. Yeah.
So what have, I mean, have you had any reactions to the more kind of community style groups to this approach?
What, the non-hierarchical?
Well, just the whole, the non-hierarchical, the kind of safer spaces thing, and then the anti, or the exclusion of political parties. I mean, because that, I'm maybe kind of generalising here, but a lot of those groups would be very familiar and comfortable in spaces or campaigns run by political parties or
leaders.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. The first thing they do is write to their MP. Like, a lot of people just... It's not a political project fighting the cuts. It's just like, I just want my life back, you know. I just don't want to have to get chucked off benefits or work when I've got cancer. Definitely. Or something like that. But, like, I mean, does, like, when you go out and talk to them, do they react well to this, or are they kind of just kind of saying, well, we'll go with you for now, but once it's done, we'll maybe go over there?
So far, no, luckily. I mean, we haven't, the space hasn't started yet, right? So we don't know how these groups are going to react, because a lot of them, although as individuals we might have worked in them, we've normally worked in situations where they're not radical spaces. So when they come into those spaces, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, like what the reaction is to the way that we organise and how things are done, you know, slightly differently. But yeah, I think it is a really good point that we are... speaking here, activists, and this is what we do, and we're very privileged that we can do that. But actually, for a lot of people coming in, it's about fighting to say the thing, they're, you know, to everything, really. Yeah. Like, you know, it's not just something that they do in their spare time, it's their life. And I think it's important to realize that privilege as well that we have as activists, that we're kind of able to do that, really.
I think, like, some of those groups are used to that more structured approach. And I think that it's important that this is trying to, like, take down all of that kind of pre-configured belief about what is the best way to do things. And if we can pull people in and then show them our politics, then hopefully, you know, it will kind of inspire people to be like, hey, actually, this is quite cool. And I know I work in a charity voluntarily sort of once a week and stuff, and it's organised relatively non-hierarchically, but there is a kind of coordinator and these kinds of things. And actually, I'm working really hard at the moment to get her to come in and to give a talk about the cuts to legal aid, which will really affect particularly sort of asylum seekers and refugees. And hopefully sort of to show her, like, this is how we organise and, you know, it works. And to try and, like... hopefully it can kind of be a learning experience for people, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have actually had a couple of groups pull out when they've realised that it's a squatted space, because we wrote on our blurb that it's a reclaimed space, which is slightly misleading.
It's keep it sick anyway.
Yeah, and because we sent out this call out and it said reclaim space as opposed to squatted space, and there are a few groups. I mean, one particularly that I was trying to get involved was a group called User Voice, who work with ex-offenders, basically trying to get rehabilitation for prisoners led by ex-offenders, and they're wicked and they do really great work, and they were really on board actually with the whole like non-hierarchical thing, because obviously, you know, being led by ex-offenders, that's very much part of their kind of thought process. But when, I mean, this is obviously quite specific to ex-offenders on probation, right? But when they found out that it was a squatted space, they didn't, although I explained to them that, you know, we were going to be in a commercial building, they still felt slightly uncomfortable with that. And there have been a couple of things where people have pulled out, and that is, you know, the strength of media narrative against squatting, right? Like, I mean, we might be saying, look, it's fine, we're going to be in a commercial building, but the squatting laws changed so recently to what we're doing that it's going to be inevitable that people are going to be like, even more so than they might have done before, like, yeah. Oh, is it legal? Isn't it legal? Yeah, you know, if you're not part of that scene, it's very hard to get that, you know, that clear boundary, because it just seemed like squatting became illegal. Like, you know, you had to know the law fairly well to know that you can still go into commercial spaces. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been, we've now put up something on our website explaining basically everything about squatting, where we will be squatting, what it is, so there's no confusion, and you know that information is up there, so so it doesn't just say reclaim now.
Nice. Right, well, we're gonna have a track now, and maybe when we come back, are we allowed to talk about the run of bad luck now?
After this. Oh, this like is ill manners
after the break.
Yeah.
They have breaks on the BBC.
Let's all go on an urban safari, we might see some illegal migrants. Oi, look, there's a chap, that means council has done violent. He's got a hoodie on, give him a hug. A second thoughts, don't, you don't wanna get mugged. Oh shit, too late, that was kinda dumb. Whose idea was that? Stupid. He's got some front, ain't we all? Be the joker, play the fool. It's politics, ain't it all? Smoke and mirrors, April Fools. All year round, all in all, just another brick in the wall. Get away with murder in the schools. Use four letter swear words, cause we're cool. We're all drinkers, drug takers. Every single one of us runs the earth. Keep on believing what you read in the papers. Council estate is gone with the earth. Thinking of a life on the council estate is from a thing you ever read about it or heard. But it's all true, so stay where you're safest. There's no need to step out the bird. Truth is here, we're all disturbed. We cheat and lie, it's so absurd. Feed the fear, that's what we've learned. Fuel the fire, let it burn. Oi, I say oi. What you looking at? Nowhere. Take the wrong turn down a one-way junction. Find yourself in the hood, nobody goes there. We got an eco-friendly government. They preserve our natural habitat. Built an entire Olympic village around where we live about. Pulling down any flats, give us free money and we don't pay any tax. NHS healthcare, yes please, many thanks. People get stabbed round here, there's many shanks. Nice knowing someone's got a back when we get attacked. Don't bloody give me that, I lose my temper. Who closed down the community centre? I killed time there, used to be a member. What will I do now until September? School's out, rules out, get your bloody tools out. London's burning, I predict a riot. Falling, fall out. Who knows what it's all about? What did that chief say? Something about the Kaisers, kids on the street. Now they never miss a beat, never miss a cheap feel when it comes their way. Let's go looting, no not looting. The high street's closer, cover your face. And if we see any rich kids on the way, we'll make them wish they stayed inside. There's a charge for congestion, everybody's gotta pay. Do what brothers does, rob them blind. Oi, I say oi. What you looking at? Politicians, you bloody rich kids never listen. There's no such thing as broken Britain. We're just bloody broke in Britain. What needs fixing is the system. Not shop windows down in Brixton. Riots on the television. You can't put a fool in prison.
Oi, I say oi. What you looking at, you little rich?
Cool, we're back. So go on then, tell us your tale of woe.
What happened to this space?
So we had a really beautiful space, which kind of politically was really strong as well. It was a library that had been closed down initially, and then it was bought by South Bank University to be a creche for students there, and then they decided that it wasn't economically viable for them, closed it down, and it had been empty for sort of about a year. There'd been a big campaign at the university to keep it open, but it failed. And so we were like, well, this is perfect. Like, we want to run a creche in the space. Like, it's an anti-cut space, so why not be in a building that's been closed because of the cuts? Like, and, you know, when we got inside, absolutely beautiful space. Like, so really amazing.
Yeah.
Just, like, completely set up for what we wanted to do. And, you know, had the disabled access, had loads of natural light, had a kitchen, you know, had
I don't
a crush
even like talking about it, it makes me sad. Like,
wow. So a kind of crew of people got in, secured it. Within kind of 40 minutes of it opening, there was the university security there, and like, you must have broken in, you know, we came here a day ago, like, you must have burgled it, like, you know, getting really like aggy and aggressive and kind of, I guess, annoyed, because like, at the end of the day, they're the kind of workers at the bottom, and it's their job to keep the place secure, and since it wasn't, they were probably getting, you know, threatened or whatever by their bosses, and so I kind of sympathize with them in that sense, but they were very annoyed, and they called the police, and hours and hours of standoff took us till about 8 a.m. when we were like, all right, we're sorted, we're secure. Some of us left, went to go and get more stuff, get more people down, start, you know, creating the space ready for opening. We kind of got quite a big group of people went in at once, about sort of 20 of us. The security got very upset by this, called the police again. And there was sort of hours and hours of standoff. And eventually they were like, right, well, we think that you're committing aggravated trespass, because the university claimed that they use this building and you're preventing them from working. Legally it was bullshit, but whatever. And so they got the TSG down.
And they were trying to do criminal damage and extraction as well, weren't they, at one point? Yeah. Like, there was a lot of back and forth, and nobody... I mean, I was outside, so I wasn't inside. But like, trying to work out what was going on was just impossible, because they were changing what the charges were every time, and what was going to happen when the TSG were going to arrive, like, were they just going to storm it or give time? Like, it was fairly manic. We had like one awesome legal guy there, but there's just no way of really knowing. Like, they're not trying to make it easy for you, really, are they? Like,
I don't care about the law.
Yeah.
But sort of the vans kind of seemed to fuck off, and then as they did, the security just went for it and like went straight in and just basically kicked down a door, and like there were loads of people inside who have got are the space crew essentially. It's not a very big group of people who are trying to find the spaces and lock them, and none of them can afford to be arrested at this point, or it won't happen. So kind of had to leave. And there was a bit of kind of confrontation and like, what the hell are you doing? But in the end, the building was lost, and the cops were going to turn a blind eye always to the fact that, you know.
Yeah. I mean, if the people who were in that space had been arrested that night, that probably would have been like it for Cuts Cafe, because it is a fairly small group of people who are doing space stuff. Because, I mean, for the reasons that I've said, it's great that we're a very diverse group of people, but actually, like, there's a lot. I personally don't have any skills whatsoever in trying to break a space. Like, I couldn't find one. I wouldn't know what to do. Like, so I think that there was a very sensible decision to leave, definitely, but also I think really sad for everyone involved, and also that, you know, it's hard to get numbers down to, you know, to do that when, you know, it's been fairly small organizing group in the beginning, I think.
So where are you at now in terms of spaces? I mean, I'm not asking you to reveal any secrets, but
$1 million question. There's a few spaces that we've kind of got. The difficulty is that if it was the kind of the normal dynamic of a squatted space, like if you're going to have a free party or if you're going to have something that's like quite geared to the existing anarchist scene, then it's really easy to find an empty space that is like
our producer man said bullshit. But I mean, I suppose relatively speaking, I think it's definitely easier to find something to break it and just have it for 24 hours or 48 hours or something like that rather than a sustained period of 2 weeks in central London, especially.
But even more so that we're looking for a kind of really quite like clean, welcoming space, the kind of space that you could bring your mum to.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, definitely. My grandma's like really up for it. So like, it's got to be good when my grandma comes around.
So that's a difficulty. And we've got a potential place lined up. Mm. We need to get some electricians in. But luckily, we've, you know, got the Sparks who had the strike a while ago doing a workshop. And some of them have said, yeah, we'll come and sort out the fucking electrics. So.
Oh, good old Sparks. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that kind of raises one of the issues you were just kind of saying about the kind of the different kind of working groups that go into a project like this and the fact that the space crew will be something separate. Mm. But it is quite an arduous kind of thing to open and then try and keep a space run and welcoming and things like that. Like how are you going to avoid things like burnout and keep this a sustainable project for those groups of people, as well as just kind of make sort of bridge the divide between the different groups of knowledge, I suppose, because politics shouldn't be compartmentalized. Like it's political to open a space, and there's obviously a reason why you're using squatted spaces or want a squatted space. So
I mean, I think there's two different things there. There will be lots of people staying there once the space is open who aren't the sort of, you know, normal squatters, kind of anarchists. So there will be a very broad range of people doing the welcoming thing, being there all the time. And we have people who work, I mean, who people do sort of like paid work or whatever. On the issue of burnout, that is a strong reason for why it's been a 2 week project, I think, really. It was why it worked amazingly at Palestine Place. I mean, I only came like sort of a couple of days in, but I think that from what I can gather, a lot of projects fall apart because people just get exhausted, because not only have you got a huge emotional investment in what you're doing and actually quite you know, traumatic things that you're talking about and that you're sharing with people, both on a political level and a personal level, which is often the same. So I think the 2 week thing will definitely contribute to that. We've got an amazing woman who's going to come in and do some sort of welfare for activists sessions. We have a lot of feelings meetings as a group, which some of us enjoy.
My life is a feelings meeting.
I think we're quite good at recognising burnout, and that was one of the things that I found incredible when I first came to Palestine Place, was that like it was an instant recognition that actually something had got too much, and an instant care and support network there when that happened. It wasn't like, well, you've got to keep going at full pelt because we've been all doing this together, and it was like, okay, right, just take some time out. Like, that's fine. Somebody else will pick up the things that you were supposed to do.
I think it's a learning process as well. Like Holly says, last time was the first time that she was in a squatted space. And we've had people this time who have like, oh, actually, like, I really see that you guys are really stressed trying to open this space. Well, I'll come and help you. And maybe I've never done it before, but hey, now's as good a time to learn as any. And equally, like, myself, like, didn't really have a lot of idea about the kind of outreachy, eventsy kind of, it's a bit like intellectual for me. Or I thought it was, I guess. And it's like, it's that coming together of people with different skills, and it is one collective group.
Definitely.
And like, you know, you have to sometimes like recognize that in any group different people will take on different roles, and as long as there's a kind of skill sharing.
Definitely. I mean, we're not separate.
Problematic.
Although we are working groups, so we do feedback a lot. I mean, space is slightly different because of the security issues surrounding it. So there's, you know, not the same level of feedback. But pretty much everybody who comes to an organising meeting knows what every group does. And I think it's a recognition of skills that you have. And I think that sometimes people get quite caught up in this thing that like, oh, you know, almost if you have a sort of skill in doing something, you've got this privilege. And it's like, no, you're using it, and skill sharing have become really important, especially in the Cuts Cafe. There's a lot of different skill shares, isn't there, happening so that people can get involved with things. I mean, skipping, squatting, like these are things that I had no idea about, and like, you know, now they're gonna, you know, be part of what people are doing if they want to get involved with things.
Yeah. And you're going to have all sorts of events next week then. So do you want to give us some highlights as to what people can expect?
I don't know if we can give you highlights. They're all pretty hot.
Yeah.
The electricity doesn't work. It might be pretty dark as well.
Candlelit.
Yeah, they'll be all romantic.
So romantic,
So we've got this sort of one, if you like, big name that we have, although we don't really, you know, like to use a big name, but we've got Ken Loach coming in, who is the director of The Wind That Shakes the Barley, Land and Freedom. He's going to be doing a screening and a Q&A, which will be really cool. And then, I mean, apart from that, in terms of, like, sort of recognisable names...
David Graeber?
Oh, David Graeber.
Oh, his Graeberness. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Lovely. What's he going to be talking about?
He's going to talk about Debt Strike.
Okay.
With somebody from Jubilee Debt. Mm-hmm. We also have somebody from The Guardian, a journalist called Dan Hancox, who is a journalist but has also written some really cool books. He wrote Kettled Youth. He was like reporting on what was happening in the student movement in 2010. Mm-hmm. He's recently written a book on Mirandela, which is the communist utopia in Spain, which is this really, really beautiful book, actually, about the fact that this is this fully living, working version of communism. And that session will also be talking about... sort of anarchist history in Spain, because I mean it's like the best example of it ever working, and in any sense really, I think. There's that. What else?
I guess I'd also say that like everything is a bit of a highlight.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
You know, you've got like Deepak coming in, you've got all of these different skill shares going on that will be really, really interesting.
We've got documentary
G8 people. They're important to mention. Yeah. They're going to have like a stall, and you know, obviously, the G8's coming up next year.
Yeah, and it's going to be here.
Mobilisation.
Yeah, Birmingham, right?
Yeah.
Well, some people say Lake District, some people say London.
I heard Birmingham for some reason.
Okay.
That shiny, amazing town of Birmingham.
The worst place I've ever lived.
That's hometown. Other highlights, actually, they're sort of coming to me. And, like, we've got two students from Quebec talking about the student movement there, which would be really cool.
Grease Solidarity Campaign.
Yeah, Grease Solidarity Campaign. We're sort of internationalising as well.
Yes, excellent.
Yeah, so we've got the Greater London Pensioners Association. We've got a group of young people who made a documentary during the riots coming in.
Just loads, basically.
Like, go on our website.
And what is the website?
The website is...
www.cutscafelondon.wordpress.org.
.net.
.net. Bloody hell.
And please go on Twitter and look at us and retweet us and things. I am in outreach working group, so I have a vested interest.
Yeah, Holly gets paid by the click.
Exactly. I get a sandwich per click, per retweet, so yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us. And we'll hear more from you, no doubt, in the next couple of weeks.
Thank you for having us.
So now we're going to hear from Mongols Hi-Fi with Boat People Feed Papa Jim.
If not, you can't leave your country. This is not a joke.
You're listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 PM GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more. Music and porn. Actually, on the porn note, we have John here, as we promised, to talk to us about pornography, masculinity, and capitalism. How are you going, John? I can't actually see you over there. You're in
no,
the dark, looking shadowy.
I am here. Can I hear myself? Yeah.
Oh, you can hear yourself.
I mean, it's quite strange. I haven't talked about this subject for 12 years, which in public, which in itself says something about the subject. 12 years ago, I kind of decided to shift kind of my own practice away from a kind of critical look at the role of porn in constructing masculinity and the addictive nature of porn within heterosexual masculinity, and I moved it away from there to anti-capitalist practices. So it's interesting to come back 12 years later and try and think about these two things together, which I haven't done very long, because I was told about this program a few hours ago. But
we're very spontaneous.
So yeah. Well, there's a very, you know, the porn and capitalism are kind of bedfellows. There's something very, very similar about the dynamics which inhabit the two things. Capitalism is fundamentally one of the energies that drives capitalism is creating lack, is actually creating a promise that can never be fulfilled. And porn is absolutely similar. Porn creates this promise of a kind of sexual utopia where everyone is available all the time. No one ever doesn't get hard. No one ever doesn't come. No one is not beautiful and perfect. And it's this promise, this kind of utopian, and utopian in the negative sense of something unfulfillable, promise which creates a lack, and that creates an addictive drive for a lot of men and some women. So porn and capitalism are fed by this unfulfilled promise. It's interesting that, you know, who were the first people over the Berlin Wall? When it came down in 1989, there were two companies. One was Saatchi & Saatchi's advertising company, and the other was Bitte Utze, which is the big German porn baroness. It's right now, the statistics in Britain are that about 10 million men are addicted to pornography. When I was doing this work 12 years ago, the statistics were showing that the porn was making bigger profits than Coca-Cola in the United States, and so it's not a small thing. Mm. And this was kind of before internet. What the work I was doing at the time was really to look at to get men to talk about it, because it's something that most men in the Western world have some experience of, and that many men are addicted to. And no one talks about it. Men don't talk about it to themselves. They don't talk about it to their partners. And I'm talking about heterosexual men here, because I think the situation is very, very different for bisexual and gay men. And I realized that it was a kind of this hole. That's a difficult word to talk about pornography. And that all the writings were by women. So, you know, most of the literature looking at pornography critically are by women. Yet 90% of porn is consumed by men, and 90% of it is produced by men. So I started to talk to men about their use of porn, and developed a 7-year kind of project which merged art and therapy and media interventions. The key thing that came out of that was a realization that actually it was something men did want to talk about. It was something that was actually a real problem for a lot of men. It was an addiction that was very, very similar to eating disorders in women. There was a very, very similar kind of binge and purge syndromes, and that it wasn't not just about sexuality. It wasn't actually about sex necessarily. It was actually really about a kind of lack of esteem in a lot of men and a sense of not being sexually desirable, and a fear of sex and having shame wrapped around the sexual act. So the project involved basically talking to a lot of men, doing video interviews with men in public spaces. And the interviews were disguised. The men were in silhouette, so you couldn't see who they were. You couldn't identify them. And a lot of men who'd worked on masculinity told me, well, you know, the men aren't going to talk to you. They're really not going to do it. You're going to have to do weeks of kind of work to get them to talk. And actually, all the men who came into the I constructed this kind of confessional booth, they just kind of poured out. They just were telling me all these stories. And the same patterns started to emerge in the research, basically. That it was basically something that men did when they were alone, when it was stressful, there was a lot of shame wrapped up in it. And that a lot of the men I talked to had experience of addiction at some point to pornography and in their lives. That material, the videos, were then edited down, and I then built a kind of completely fake sex shop. No one knew it wasn't real. It was in a high street in Nottingham, and it had like live neons saying live show, and it had a kind of seedy guy standing in the hallway behind a booth kind of saying, oh, come on in, it's the first week, we've just opened, everything's free. And guys would come in not knowing it was funded by the Arts Council of Great Britain. They would come in and they would see these long corridors with lots of doors, as if it was a video booth shop where you'd go in and watch porn videos. And the booths were shut, and there was the sound of porn coming underneath the doors. And then two were open, and they could go in, and they would, instead of watching porn, they would watch men talk about porn. And then they'd go further down into the space, and there was this kind of peep show. And there was this, they'd look in, and the peep show, they'd look through the glass of the peep show, and it had this text which said, "Nothing is inside, but everything is wanting." And that backwards, which is wanting, but nothing is inside. And for me, that phrase, which works backwards and forwards, was the kind of really said it all about capitalism and porn, in a way, this kind of sense of that there's nothing inside, but everything is wanting. And so men would look through this peep show, and they would see the figure in latex and high heels and suspenders dancing around the carcass of a pig in this dry ice. And this figure would take off its clothes, dress the pig, and then it revealed to be me in drag. And that was really looking at the sense that porn is, for a lot of men that I talked to, porn was actually about transferring they wanted to be desirable. Now, this 12 years ago, the kind of sexualized image of the masculine body was much, much less common than it is now. Mm-hmm. And so there was this real, you know, this desire for a lot of these men, it was a desire to have, to be desired in the way, and objectified in a way. The desire to be objectified was this kind of strange kind of thing that was going on, and being sexual not for the size of their wallet, not for the size of their strength, not for their car, but just purely for their kind of body. And so anyway, the show happened, lots of men got angry, they tried to smash down the peep show, understandably. I then did a whole workshop with talk about men, heterosexual men and gay men working together to talk about these issues, and then the press got hold of that, and then it became a big press story in British media and got a lot of media, and through that met some therapists. And then the second part of the work was actually developing methodology with therapists to work with men, and this was seen as an art project, but it was working with men who are addicted to porn, and did a 2-year project working with men addicted to porn, and not having a kind of judgmental practice where it's not saying, you know, porn is bad, shouldn't be using it, but it's saying porn is there, it's in your life, you're addicted to it, how can you actually be happier? Because no addiction is healthy, you know, because the addiction controls you, you're no longer in control of it. And continued that work, and then we launched a kind of helpline, and then the media went completely crazy when we launched the helpline, and had to do awful things like go on Rich and Judy's show and Esther and all these things, and Radio 4 Today program, talking about my own experience of porn, my own addiction at the porn. So it's interesting. I mean, that's 12 years ago, that work, and then but I think the issue is even greater now with the internet, with the, you know, it's really on tap. I mean, when I was doing this work, you had to have some kind of public, you know, you had to talk to someone, and now you can basically be alone and literally plugged in directly to your substance, which is pretty scary. And I think it's also interesting to see that, you know, all the internet development, a lot of it has been due to porn sites. A lot of the technological development around video streaming and so on, all that stuff, and Skype and stuff, has all happened because of porn sites. So it's still a huge issue and no one's talking about it, and I think it's really courageous of you to do this program and begin to talk about it. And it's interesting now, my big interest is Charles Fourier, and in a way Fourier, I'm not going to talk a great deal about Fourier, I've got 0 seconds to talk anymore. But just to say that Fourier imagined a kind of post-capitalist world, a kind of ecological post-capitalist world, where actually instead of money being the kind of dynamic exchange, desire was the dynamic exchange, that actually the whole economy would be based on desire, your desire for others and your desire for activities. And it was a kind of like a sexualized world where there was no shame and no fear. And I hope that one day we'll reach that state.
Sexy.
And thanks, Anya, for providing that very interesting piece of audio.
Not off talking about. So we're here with Secret Archives of the Vatican. How's it going, lads?
It's going good.
Yeah.
So, what's with the name?
It's his fault.
It is my fault.
Many years ago, I got a book out of the public library called Secret Archives of the Vatican, just because of a title. It kind of sounded intriguing, and I never read it. I think I smuggled it back into the library when it was 8 years overdue, so I didn't have to pay the fine. Actually, somebody bought me a copy of it a couple of years ago for Christmas, and it's on my shelf, but I've never
read it. No, you're still not.
I just thought it would be a good band name.
Excellent. Okay. And so, yeah, you're going to be playing tunes for us tonight, all produced by yourselves?
By the two of us. It's all our own material, apart from the stolen bits.
And all Creative Commons, is it?
Yeah, we release everything free of charge. We use a website called Bandcamp, which is great actually, because it's totally flexible in terms of how you charge or don't charge. So you can be a big record label and go on there and charge whatever, or you can just be some, you know, bedroom artists can just put your music on there free, anything in between. And what we do is we allow people to pay if they want to and not if they don't want to, and maybe about 10% of people choose to pay.
Oh, nice.
And do you, like, is this your day job then, or?
I wish.
Okay.
No, it's not. I work full time for a charity, and
I'm not going to say who I work for.
Okay. He works for a telecommunications company.
Boo. Do you reckon you could like make a living for it if you weren't so nice about everything?
No. The music industry that we all grew up with is dead and gone. It's gone. You cannot make a living as a musician, which is great in my view, in some ways. It's the whole thing has just democratized itself as MP3s are invented, and everybody's got the internet now, so suddenly you're on a level playing field with anybody and you can make music. And because you're not an employee of a record company or something, you're not under any pressure to do anything in particular, so you've got complete creative control to do whatever you like, and you can get your music out to the entire world, and it's just down to how much effort you put in on getting online and pimping yourself.
Yeah. And so what kind of music are you going to be playing tonight?
It's a mix. We're going to play all our own tunes tonight. We don't always, but tonight we are. And we kind of mix breakbeat and dubstep and drum and bass and Indian and Arabic and Turkish music influences, and a bit of this, bit of that, a little bit of hip hop.
Yeah,
it won't sound like any of that, but anyway, that's the, that's the theory of it.
I keep trying to make it sound like that, but it never works.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well done.
Cool. Right, look forward to that. Well, you were on in 5 minutes. So do you want to go limber up? And we'll do a few announcements.
Just don't watch him limbering up. It's not a pretty sight.
Right, we'll go in chronological order. Why not?
Yeah.
So there's a Global Noise Day on Saturday, 13th of October at 2 p.m. outside the London Stock Exchange. It's going to be workshops, talks, and a chance to meet real activists from around the world and hear their stories. So yeah, it's a kind of all about the it's the start of the week of the 20th of October, which is the big TUC demo. So it's kind of part of the build up for that.
Yeah, there's the Defend the Right to Protest National Conference on Sunday, the 14th of October at 11:30. It's going to be charged wage £6 and unwaged £3 at the Yulu on Mallet Street. And this conference will be taking place as people prepare for an autumn of struggle, because we're not always struggling in some way. The TUC March Against Austerity, that's coming up. There's also going to be the National Union of Students Education demonstration in November. And so, yeah, I guess like kind of reflecting upon reasons to involve yourself in that and actual practical things as well.
And on the 19th of October at 1 p.m. at Victoria Station, sorry, this is all very London centric, there's the Fights for Sites Mass Action Day. I don't think it's targeting Victoria Station, so that's a neat point. But it's on the anniversary of the storming of Dale Farm last year. And finally, the big event.
Yeah, this is not a recession. This is a robbery on Saturday, the 20th of October at 11 a.m. at Blackfriars Victoria Embankment. And people who are disaffected with the Tories and the Lib Dems, as well as trade unionists, lefties and pensioners and young people. Basically, yeah, what are they doing?
Go and march, go, mate, go and march. Go shopping.
Better than consuming, I guess.
Yeah. So it's not just Blackfriars, that's one block. There's blocks leaving from St. Paul's and Parliament Square. And I'm just going to say there's a bunch of other ones. So if you don't have a block, maybe start your own.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
Cool. And some shout outs. I'd like to give a shout out to Anya and to Julia and Moo and Brian and G and Neil.
Hiya.
Hiya.
Go on, the lads.
Radio, 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 what? No.
No. Yo. Nice. Dissonant Island.
Murder style. Let's go to the old boy car with the, you know, when I run gonna win original bad boy and think panel. What the lights on the man and them there?
Yep. Radio.
You're listening to the
Archivio Segreto Vaticano.
Secret Archives of the Vatican. How about that for a band name?
Yeah, right, yeah.
Transglobal breakbeat dub science and the Secret Archives of the Vatican.
Something is happening to the children of Mars.
Thank you.
to the children of Mars.
You must do something about it. Do something about it.
I know. But what?
Do something.
be friendly. You will be aloof, watchful, and suspicious.
Both your defense and your attack are very good. You must have practiced very hard.
I tell you frankly, I know that I'm the best fighter in the world.
Thank you. read stories more than bread itself. They tell us how to live. And why. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back. confirmed dead and several more seriously wounded. We heard the gunmen burst into the church. They locked the doors and opened fire indiscriminately. Five members of one family were killed and there were bullet holes all round the church. No one has claimed responsibility as yet. The government has said it's deeply saddened by the event. So tensions are very high now among the Christian community. We could see more attacks if security isn't heightened.